See, we've got our own brother Mike to speak to us this evening on Legion. So we'll take a suitable reading from the Gospel of Mark, and chapter 5, and the first 20 verses. Mark chapter 5. And the disciples came over unto the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gadarenes. And when he was come out of the ship, immediately there met him, out of the tombs, a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no man could bind him, no, not with chains, because that he had been often bound with fetters and chains, and the chains had been plucked asunder by him, and the fetters broken in pieces, neither could any man tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying and cutting himself with stones. But when he saw Jesus afar off, he ran and worshipped him, and cried with a loud voice and said, What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? I adjure thee, by God, that thou torment me not. For he said unto him, Come out of the man, thou unclean spirit. And he asked him, What is thy name? And he answered, saying, My name is Legion, for we are many. And he besought him much that he would not send them away out of the country. Now there was there, nigh unto the mountain, a great herd of swine feeding. And all the devils besought him, saying, Send us into the swine, that we may enter into them. And forthwith Jesus gave them leave. And the unclean spirits went out and entered into the swine, and the herd ran violently down a steep place into the sea. They were about 2,000, and were choked in the sea. And they that fed the swine fled, and told it in the city and in the country. And they went out to see what it was that was done. And they come to Jesus, and see him that was possessed with the devil, and had the legion sitting and clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And they that saw it told them how it befell to him that was possessed with the devil, and also concerning the swine. And they began to pray him to depart out of their coasts. And when he was come into the ship, that he that had been possessed with the devil prayed him that he might be with him. Howbeit Jesus suffered him not, but saith unto him, Go home to thy friends, and tell them how great things the Lord hath done for thee, and hath had compassion on thee. And he departed and began to publish in Decapolis how great things Jesus had done for him, and all men did marvel. Call upon our brother Mike now to give us his address on Legion.
Very good evening, everyone. Let's have a look then at this record. Oh, pencil's come from somewhere, is that yours, Dave? Have a look at this record that we have here of Legion. It's not easy, is it? It's, as we read it, we perhaps think, things here I don't understand. So we'll see how we get on. Now, we've got three parallel records of this incident found in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And although it's clear that they're speaking about the same event, there are some differences between them. And we're going to note some of those differences as we pass, but not really concentrate on trying to reconcile those and make that the main point. We'll just notice them as we go. We're going to use all the records, of course, because that's the way that we get the fullest picture of what happened. So, as we've seen from the Mark reading, if we just glance back, if you've got your Bibles open still at Mark 5, if you glance back into the end of the previous chapter, we find it's a sea crossing over Galilee, and it's the stilling of the storm. And when the time when Jesus said, Peace, be still, and the storm stopped suddenly, and of course it made them fearful. that even the wind and the sea could were obedient, as it were, to Jesus. So we'll just keep that in the back of our minds as well. Now, I think if it's all right with you, I'll say when I'm taking the quotes from, but we won't look every one up because it's jumping about a bit. And I think perhaps if I just read some of the verses to you, it might just speed things up a little bit for us. If we're in Matthew 8 and verse 18, and we look at that record, we learn that it was the build-up of the crowds around Jesus that led Jesus to command that they go into a boat and that they cross that sea crossing. That's the crossing where the storm happened. So they were going from Capernaum across onto the eastern shore. And we read in Matthew 8 and verse 18, "Now when Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave orders to go over to the other side." And we see this a number of times, don't we, where Jesus didn't want huge crowds because he knew what that could lead to. So he wanted to get away from the crowds. Now in Mark's account, we learn that the other boats that were there, some of them left at the same time. They went on that same journey. So we can assume that they were subject to the same storm on the water, that there must have been, mustn't they? And presumably subject to the same calm, unexpectedly, as well. And presumably those in the other boats, not with Jesus, perhaps even felt more fear, more amazement at what was happening to them and the unusual weather and sea conditions. In Mark's account, chapter 4 and verse 35, it just says, "On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, 'Let us go across to the other side.' And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. And other boats were with them, and a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling." So that's the background, what had gone just before. The Luke account puts the healing of Legion in the same time period, but it's worth noting what Jesus had been doing in the time before he decided to cross the water. We can perhaps learn why the crowds were there. And we learn this from Matthew chapter 8, and it's verse 14, where we read, "And Jesus entered into Peter's house. He saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she arose and began to serve him." So there's one miracle, one of the very early miracles that Jesus did, isn't it? But it carries on. "That evening they brought to him many who were oppressed with demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick." So a lot of healing. It's interesting that there's a mention of the casting out of demons and the mention of spirits there, which is clearly going to tie in with what happens on the other side of the lake. And we can imagine why the crowds gathered around, perhaps in the hope of more people being healed or just to see this wonderful thing. So we notice the emphasis on healing those with demons. And the language, of course, we understand today, reflects the understanding of that day, which of course the disciples shared. You'll recall that later, much later, I think after the Transfiguration, Jesus came down from the mountain to find some small commotion amongst the disciples and the members of the public that were around them. The disciples on that occasion had failed to cure the illness of a man's son described as a lunatic. And later, after Jesus had healed the boy, by rebuking the demon, it says, his disciples asked the question recorded in Matthew 17, "Why could we not cast him out?" Their understanding was that something had entered into a person, and what they couldn't do and find a way of doing was to get that thing out of the person again, because that's what they believed in their understanding had to happen. And, you know, we still find relics of this in our language today, this idea of something getting inside us. You know, what's possessed you? I don't know if anybody said that to you, but certainly what's got into you today, I think I can hear somebody saying that is quite close to me. It's there, isn't it, you know, in our language still. So back in Matthew 8, where we found that Jesus had cast out demons in Galilee, before leaving by boat to cross the lake, we're given a reason why Jesus did those things. And it's in verse 17 of Matthew 8. And this is, I think, it's only today looking at this again, I've realised perhaps some more of the implications of this. In Matthew 8 and verse 17, we read, "This was to fulfil that which was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases." So Jesus did these miracles, and it was a fulfilment of the prophecy that he would do these things. But as much as the reference here is to the casting out of demons, it made me think, well, back in Isaiah, it talks about that as an illness or a disease, you know, which is more the way we see it today, isn't it, when people are afflicted by such things. Now, just for a moment then, let's have a look at the region, geographically as it were, where the meeting with Legion happened. There are three different place names presented to us in the Gospels in relation to this miracle. And it does depend on what versions of the Bible you've got as well as to what you find in front of you. It was clearly the other side of the lake, there's no doubt about that, and was therefore in the Gentile region of Decapolis, or the Ten Cities. It was an area of ten cities which had been developed, I think, by the Romans. Now, Matthew describes the location in his Gospel as the country of the Gergesenes, if you've got an AV, or the Gadarenes, if you're reading Matthew in the ESV. That's the first confusion. In Mark, it's the country of the Gerasenes in the ESV, or the Gadarenes in the AV. And in Luke's Gospel, it's the Gerasenes or the Gadarenes. So, and when you try and sort it out, no commentators seem able to reconcile these names. Probably because towns and areas could have the same name. So, for example, Samaria. It was a town or a city, and it was also a whole area. So maybe similar things apply here. And it's been suggested that a town at that time, some way away from the Sea of Galilee, could have had part of the shore that belonged to that town, as it were, perhaps a fishing or something like that, and that would bring the name of the town also to that part of the lake, which I thought was an interesting possibility. Anyway, not really of much consequence. Three things are important, though, in relation to where this place was. One, it had to be near enough to the lakeside for Legion to approach Jesus not long after Jesus had got out of the boat, because that's how it's described. There had to be a large slope of some kind, large enough to hold 2,000 pigs, that's quite a lot of animals, isn't it, which sort of steepened to a cliff at the edge of the water, because we know, as we've read, the record of them going over the edge. And there had to be tombs nearby. Now, I don't intend to spend time on this geographical aspect, really, because I don't think it really takes us much further. But we'll just again notice a few things as we pass along. Now, what about the breeding of pigs? Because that's always part of the discussion, isn't it, when we're looking at this record here. It's often suggested that these pigs, in large numbers clearly, were being bred to feed the Roman troops that were garrisoned in the area. Who was raising these pigs? Well, we're not told, but it's often suggested that they might have been Jews who had found a business opportunity and were prepared to leave behind elements of keeping the law with its prohibitions. And maybe that they were raising these pigs and earning money from it to feed the Romans. Maybe some felt able to justify keeping animals, like keeping the pigs, as long as they didn't eat them. No, maybe that was just a thought. And if that was the case, they would probably arouse as much hostility from fellow Jews for feeding Romans as for the breaking of the law. It's just background stuff, really, isn't it? It is interesting to find in some commentaries, when you look at them, that the term pigs was used by the Jews to refer to Romans. Some see a connection there. Possibly also because, which is surprising, I think, the emblem or the mascot of the Roman legion that was overseeing Jerusalem Their mascot was a pig, apparently. And whilst on that subject, it's also reckoned by some that the legion of Romans that was stationed in and around Jerusalem numbered only 2,000 compared to the normally larger number for a legion. And so some make an immediate link with the 2,000 swine and start to see some link with the destruction of the swine and a prophecy of the destruction of the Romans. It doesn't hold much for me there. Because let's face it, the destruction of the Roman power was a long way off still, and the scattering of the Jews had to come first. But just to share what are some of what I found out. Now let's move to that name Legion, which this sick man had given himself, or at least referred to himself with that name. Where it came from, we're not quite sure. The name Legion, in association with this miracle, is not found anywhere else in Scripture in its singular form. Just one, Legion, as it were. The word legions is found just once, and you know where that is. And it's when Jesus refers to the legions of angels that could be present from his Father. 12 legions of angels. A legion was a heavy infantry division of the Roman army. And it consisted normally of getting on for 5,000 fighting men together with backup slaves who would undertake background duties and maintenance and things like that. So to find out why the troubled man adopted this name, we go to the gospel records. Now I'm opening Mark, and Mark 5 verse 9 says this. Mark 5 verse 9, Jesus asked him, "What is thy name?" And he answered, saying, "My name is Legion, for we are many." Luke's account, if you go to that, gives the same information in the form of a report about what the man said. So it's the same thing, but done as a report, not directly. Jesus asked him, saying, "What is thy name?" And he said, "Legion, because many devils were entered into him." That was the man's explanation. So the man's own understanding was that he was more than one person, because he had in fact been invaded by something that was influencing him, as it were. And it may well be that others had impressed this upon him as a rationale for his confused condition, his violence, the way that he was. Mark 5 and verse 15 says this, "And they came to Jesus and see him that was possessed with the devil and had the legion." So other people saw that this man had the legion, is the way it comes across there. And by the time we get to verse 15, he was clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid, and Jesus had cured him by that time. So his condition was so severe, the thinking would perhaps go, he wasn't just inhabited by one demon, he was inhabited by a whole legion of demons. We can perhaps imagine how he would have ended up with the name or thought of himself in that way. These things are so strange to our ears, aren't they? But it's the thinking of the day, isn't it, that is reflected here. And Jesus uses this in his teaching from time to time. Think of Jesus' picture of the unclean spirit leaving a man and then returning with seven more worse than himself. That's an example, isn't it, that Jesus uses in his teaching. Now, another thought which was passed to me concerning the name Legion was linked to the tombs that he lived in and around, because we're told that, aren't we? There is apparently evidence to suggest that many of the graves in the area, at that area, would have been the graves of Roman soldiers. And the inscriptions on their tombs would have stated their name and which legion they were from. So if this man was literate and he was wandering around in the tombs, the suggestion is that he would be constantly reminded of this idea of a legion all the time. Something to think about. So perhaps this man's thinking was that the spirits that had come out of these dead people had entered into him in some way. So let's now consider another aspect of the record which does raise questions for those who mistrust the integrity of God's word, and it gives them food for doubt, as we might say. In Matthew's account, which gives less detail overall, there is a mention of two men coming from the tombs to meet Jesus. And if we follow the record through, we find in Matthew 8 and verse 28, when he came to the other side, to the country of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men met him, coming out of the tombs, so fierce that no one could pass that way. In Matthew's gospel, words like they and us are always used. There is no mention of just one person. It's focused on two. In Mark and Luke, there's just the mention of one man. And commentators deal with this in different ways. There is a view that sees Matthew doubling up on things on a number of occasions in his record. I won't go into the detail. I could see perhaps there's some argument. Matthew does seem to double up the numbers sometimes compared to other Gospels, possibly to make a point, maybe to emphasise something, to state the importance. Another view is, well, there were two men there that came out towards Jesus, perhaps one copying the other or something like that, perhaps one that was more shy than the other, one was more forthcoming, one even guarding the other or supporting him or something, and that the dialogue that Jesus had was just focused on the one of the two. What we know is that Scripture always tells the truth, don't we? Don't we doubt that at all. So there's going to be an explanation. It's just that we can't perhaps know. Well, we'll leave that aside and concentrate on the record of what took place now between Jesus and this one man. When we consider that miracles were done for a teaching purpose, as we particularly learn from John, as well as a result of the compassion of our Lord, then the apparent accuracy, the final accuracy of the details, loses its significance, doesn't it, really? We think about the more important things about what it all means. Well, so far we've looked at the subject under sort of headings, where it is, name, legion, and so on. So from now on, we'll just move through the record. We'll use the Mark account as a basis because that's a fuller account. There are major themes and questions which are associated with this miracle, such as, what does this teach us about demons or devils? Doesn't Jesus in this miracle seem to be supporting false understanding about mental illness or things like that? What are the lessons that we can learn from this event? What was Jesus, through the gospel writers, really trying to convey to us, perhaps in our day? Which Old Testament passages and ideas might form some kind of backdrop to this record? So we'll see if we can dig up some of these. So we go to Mark 5 and back to verse 1 there. They came to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gadarenes, and when he was come out of the ship, immediately, it's one of Mark's words, isn't it? Immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. There was something unusual about this man that must have been obvious at first sight. It was quite recognisable that he wasn't... He didn't present it as you would normally expect people to. Now, it's been pointed out by a number of commentators that the storm and the stilling of that storm on the lake are sort of paralleled here by a storm on land in this man and his behaviour, which then Jesus stills, which is quite a nice idea, whether it's really there or not. But, you know, there's two stillings of a storm in a sense, and one relates to this man. Now, it takes a while for a boat, which is very visible. If it only needs a little boat on a flat piece of sea and you can see it for miles, can't you? You're aware of it. It takes a while, though, for a boat that's highly visible on the water to reach the land. And we can imagine that this agitated man, Legion, possibly with another man, as we said, was there watching this boat. Wouldn't be much else to do, would there? So you would look out to sea, wouldn't you, if you were there? And he was ready to make his presence known, it seems, as soon as the boat beached. He was waiting for it. Was Legion surprised to see any boat arriving at all, given the ferocity of the storm that must have been throwing waves up onto the beach where he was? He must surely have known about that storm. Had he himself noticed the sudden calm that had come in the weather? What was this man like? Well, Mark 5 and verse 3, we read it in our reading. He had his dwelling in the tombs. No man could bind him, not with chains. I mean, he must have been really strong, wasn't he? And because he'd often been bound with fetters and chains, and the chains had been plucked asunder by him, and the fetters broken in pieces, it says, neither could any man tame him. It seems that really they'd sort of given up trying to control him by physically tying him down, as it were. So all was night and day, it says. He was here in the mountains and in the tombs, crying and cutting himself with stones. What a dramatic picture this is of this wild man. Very strong, probably naked. Why do I say that? Because later it says he became clothed. So it suggests that he wasn't before. Bruised, possibly bleeding because of his violence. Normally known to be violent, calling out. And the setting is this barren place of caves and tombs. And the information we're given about him says as much about the society that he lived in some ways, and had once been part of, as it does about the man himself. And you don't have to go back far into the history of this country, do you, really, to find barbaric attitudes and antidotes to mental illness. And you think about all the witches that were dunked and things like that. You know, you don't have to go back too far, even in the history of this country, to find a great misunderstanding about people who were different. Well, this man was clearly an outcast from his society, along with others like him. And in an effort to protect him from his violence to himself and to others he met, they tried to tie him up, but to no avail. So we imagine that in the end, this man, along with others, were left to fend for themselves, creating a no-go area, I would think. You know, how many people would want to go there if it was that dangerous? And graveyards, of course, have always conjured up fears and stories of ghosts and ghouls and spirits. And, you know, a couple of days ago, was it 3 days ago, everybody was balmy in this country in that sort of way as well. There'd be no shortage of stories about what these spirits could do and their ability to control people's minds and so on. So let's ask a question. Would the fishermen, the disciples navigating these boats, have known about the reputation of this bit of the shoreline? Well, surely yes, they knew Galilee well, didn't they? Would they have not perhaps suggested to Jesus that a little bit further up the coast or a little bit further down the coast might have been a little bit better than heading for where they were heading? You know, you sort of imagine that kind of thing might happen. So we can only imagine that Jesus knew exactly where they were heading for, and it was his full intention to go there and to visit it rather than avoid it. And Jesus began to walk towards the higher ground after getting off the boat from the water's edge, and then this amazing thing happened, which we read of in verse 6 of Mark 5. And when he saw Jesus afar off, this wild, violent man, he ran and worshipped him and cried with a loud voice, "What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God?" This was really probably very unusual behaviour and most unexpected. Wasn't it? So why did this happen? And then he said, "I adjure thee by God that thou torment me not." Well, it's easy after reading Mark 5 verse 2, where we read the word immediately, where that word used, to overlook what we're told a few verses later in Mark 5 verse 6. "And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him." So it wasn't that he was on the beach, was it? He had to run to get to Jesus. This was a man who made a conscious decision to reach Jesus. And there were other people there, the disciples. This wasn't a man just desperate for human contact, anybody, or just a man bent on mischief and hurting whoever happened to be around. This was a man who recognized Jesus for who he was, because we've just read that, and he singled out Jesus, it seems, and he made a deliberate move to go to be with Jesus. And if he recognized Jesus, what does that tell us? Does that tell us that he'd met Jesus before? if he recognised Jesus and knew about him, it rather suggests it, doesn't it? Come to John 6 and verse 37. John 6 and verse 37. John 6 and verse 37. And this is a principle that Jesus says. All that the Father giveth me shall come to me, and him that cometh to me I will in no wise cast out. For I am come from heaven, not to do mine own will, but the will of him that sent me. And this is the Father's will which has sent me, that of all which he hath given me I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. And this is the will of him that sent me, that every one which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day. So that's the Jesus' understanding of his work, isn't it? And what an interesting situation we have here. This man has clearly come to Jesus very deliberately, and yet he says to Jesus, "What have I to do with thee?" It's almost as though this man knew that Jesus was coming to him. It does rather suggest that they'd met before in some way. The words, "What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God," are not over surprising to us, are they? Why? Well, surely because this was not an uncommon response to Jesus. It seems that those whose thinking, who came in touch with Jesus, who were generally confused or had some sort of illness of some kind, were often able to recognise Jesus for who he was, when others wouldn't, but they could see clearly, as it were. I'll just read to you two similar passages. One's Mark 3 and verse 11. "And unclean spirits, when they saw him, fell down before him and cried, Thou art the Son of God." They could see directly. And Luke 4 verse 41, "And devils also came out of many, crying out and saying, Thou art Christ, the Son of God. And he, rebuking them, suffered them not to speak, for they knew that he was the Christ." So there were times when those afflicted with some kind of illness, some derangement, something that we perhaps wouldn't understand, recognised Jesus as the Son of God and sometimes as the Messiah. Well, the man, back to Legion, the man's instinct was not to attack Jesus, not to threaten him, but it was to fall at his feet and to worship him. And it's Luke's record that says he fell at Jesus' feet. But then we read in verse 7 of Mark 5 those words of Legion, "What have I to do with thee?" Or the ESV says, What have you to do with me?" The next verse in Mark's account helps us with the order of events a little bit. And it's verse 8. "For he, Jesus, said," that is, "had said unto him, Come out of the man, thou unclean spirit." "Come out of the man, thou unclean spirit," said Jesus. And then the man said, "What have I to do with thee?" That seems to be the order. We'll return in a moment to ask why Jesus would have used those words. But Jesus' commanding words received the response summarised by Mark and Matthew. So in Mark 5 and verse 7, "He cried with a loud voice and said, What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? I adjure thee by God that thou torment me not." We've already looked at that. In Matthew's account, remember we have the two men here, Matthew chapter 8 and verse 29, we read, "And behold, they," because there were two, "they cried out, What have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" So it's similar, but it's in the plural. It would appear that the man feared punishment for the state that he was in. Maybe it was his society again. Had instilled in his mind regularly that he was bad and that he was going to be punished terribly one day for it. If he was indeed a Jew who had departed from the law, he may have been very conscious of his sin and had a great fear of judgment. Isaiah 66 and verse 17, I'll just read this to you. And imagine this man's situation, and if he was a Jew and he knew his scriptures, he would know this verse. Isaiah 66 and verse 17. "They that sanctify themselves and purify themselves in the gardens behind one tree in the midst, eating swine's flesh, and the abomination and the mouse shall be consumed together, saith the Lord. So if he got anything to do with those pigs in some way, maybe that will come to his mind. And the previous chapter in Isaiah 65 and verse 4 says, which remain among the graves and lodge in the monuments, which eat swine's flesh and broth of abominable things is in their vessels. Is there any connection in any way between these verses in Isaiah and the record? But if the man was a Jew, we assume he would know these passages. The teaching in this chapter in Isaiah is that for people involved in such practices, as we just read of, no offerings would be acceptable to God. And if these chapters do form a backdrop to Legion's thinking in some way and to the miracle, it would seem highly likely that he was a Jew, wouldn't it? Moving on. In Luke's account, it seems that the man's demons, or the voices in his head resulting from his distorted thinking, were steering him away from the idea of their destruction. So we've got to try and imagine that he believed he got these demons, these whatever it was inside him, and he didn't really want them to be actually destroyed, it seems. So Luke 8 and verse 31, it says, and they besought him that he would not command them to go into the deep. Don't destroy us, don't put us into the deep, or the abyss, as it's translated. And I think that idea of the abyss apparently is the idea of a bottomless pit of destruction. But he didn't want that, it seems. So let's ask now. Well, first of all, how did he recognise who Jesus was? We can only assume that perhaps he'd been exposed to Jesus' presence and Jesus' teaching before. And maybe when he was in a rational state of mind. Maybe in moments when he recognised the truth of Christ's identity. In the ship, following the calming of the storm, the disciples had said, what sort of man is this, that even the winds and the sea obey him? Even the disciples were struggling to come to terms with Jesus' identity at that time, weren't they? Legion, having announced that he knew who Jesus was, then finds himself being asked by Jesus, what is your name? And he asked him, verse 9 of chapter 5 of Mark, what is thy name? And he answered, Legion, my name is Legion, for we are many. Notice, my name, for we are many, which is quite interesting. He's got this confusion, hasn't he, about whether he's one person or whether he's lots of people. Well, moving on, using the Matthew record now, in Matthew 8 and verse 30, we read, now a herd of many pigs was feeding at some distance from them, and the demons begged him, saying, if you cast us out, send us away into the herd of pigs. And he said to them, go. So they came out and went into the pigs, and behold, the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the waters. Very unusual record, isn't it, this? Who said go? I don't know. I can't quite get, well, can't anywhere near get to the bottom of this. Was it that Jesus said go? Was it that in the man's head, he sort of asked a question and then sort of in his head gave permission for this to happen? Something to think about. Mark 5 and verse 10 says, and he besought him much that he would not send them away out of the country. Now there was nigh... There was nigh unto the mountains a great herd of swine feeding. And all the devils besought him, saying, send us into the swine, that we may enter into them. And it says then, and forthwith Jesus gave them leave. So maybe a bit of a pointer there as to how it all works out. And the unclean spirits went out and entered into the swine, and the herd ran into the sea, about 2,000, and they were choked. So that's the record there. The answer would seem to be, from this reading, that it was Jesus that said, go. But so I'm interested in what people think. If you look at the same verse in the ESV version, it reads, and they in Mark 5 and verse 12, and they begged him, saying, send us to the pigs, let us enter them. So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered into the pigs. And we know what happened next. So you get this whole interesting thing, don't you, that we know Jesus wouldn't have dialogue with things that don't exist. So clearly it's all to do with this man's condition and what he thinks is going on in his mind. So what perhaps on a quick reading looks straightforward, actually I think can get quite complicated. Could it be that in the presence of Jesus, perhaps bringing to mind any learning from his previous encounters with Jesus, this man had found the strength and the faith to overcome his delusions for a moment? And if this is the case, the miracle of Jesus would be to give Legion the benefit of seeing something actually happen to, as a result of his change of mind, to prove to him that something had happened, that things had changed. That's one way of looking at it. Legion had been reluctant to have his imagined demons sent into the deep or the abyss, a fictional creation. Perhaps his agreement in his head, if it was that, for his imagined demons to go into the pigs, meant that he understood that they would stay in the area, what he imagined, but in the pigs rather than him. Very difficult to imagine what was in his mind. The fact that he saw the pigs on the hillside rushing to their destruction and at the same time felt in himself that he was healed must have been an amazing experience for him and for everybody else there. And there in front of him was Jesus. So he would make the connection, wouldn't he? This was because of Jesus. So here we reach this sort of crucial section. How are we to understand it? In fact, it might pay to ask ourselves a question. If that sequence of events happened today in our presence, if we observed it like the disciples did, what explanation would we give to it today? If there was a healing in front of us and then a load of animals did something really bizarre, you know, what would we make of it? How would we tie it all together today? A more up-to-date, enlightened understanding of some of the causes of mental illness wouldn't still be able to provide an explanation for what happened to the pigs, would it? That part's a separate thing. So, but it was a miracle, of course, and Jesus caused it to happen. So why could Jesus not just have healed this man's troubled mind without involving these pigs? Surely he could have done that, couldn't he? Possibly it was to provide, as I suggested, a form of evidence to Legion and others that he had the power to make a difference. If there was no visible evidence that something had happened, would Legion trust that he'd been permanently cured? It wasn't like the lame or the blind who could see and things like that, was it? It was a bit different. Would he himself and other observers have made and retained that conviction of a link between the healing and Jesus? After all, sometimes people with a disturbed mind do just get better, don't they? Or get better for a while. But now, there was not just a question of whether one man, notorious for his violent behaviour, but within the confines of a small geographical area, had recovered, but there was this irrational and absurd behaviour of 2,000 pigs careering to their deaths. The story would travel a long way, wouldn't it? It would spread like wildfire. And it would take some explaining, even with the thinking of the day. So when Legion set off on his preaching mission at Jesus' behest, as we read in our reading he did, everyone would have known that Jesus had been with him when the pigs went crazy. Surely only the Son of God could do that. So the big question for us is, did Jesus actually cause those pigs to run headlong into the water at great loss to their owners? It does seem a little bit unlikely in that we don't read of other things being done by Jesus like that, do we? Jesus didn't deliberately set out to cause harm to people's livelihoods and things like that. Perhaps a bit in the temple, we could say, but I can't think of any other examples. Did Jesus know that these animals were going to be spooked by something, as animals can be, and therefore use the opportunity and link the two things together? Did the man shriek out or cry in a loud voice in alarm? We do read sometimes in the miracles that somebody shouts out, don't we, or cries out in a very loud voice when when they're healed from a similar kind of condition. Did the voice carry? Did that spook the animals and cause the animals to run down into the water? Just ideas. Moving on. The effect of the cure of Legion was immediate. Clothes were found for him, and he put them on, and by the time the first onlookers, who'd heard about the news, arrived at the scene, there he was, sitting at Jesus' feet and in his right mind. Isn't that a wonderful expression? Isn't that what we want to be? Sitting at Jesus' feet in our right mind? That's a desire of all of us, isn't it? So perhaps a thought we can take away there. Let's turn to Mark 5 and verse 14. It might still be on the page. It says in verse 14, "And they that fed the swine fled and told it in the city and in the country, and they went out to see what was done. And they came to Jesus, and they saw him that was possessed with the devil and had the legion sitting and clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And they that saw it told how it befell to him that was possessed with the devil, and also concerning the swine. And they began to pray him to depart out of their coast." Quite why, he's not sure. Maybe they thought, we don't want all of the animals running down into the water. We could do without this. Not quite clear. It's a sad reflection on the men of the day that they chose to ignore the undeniable evidence and the huge implications of Jesus' ability to recover such a man to his sanity. How many of their families needed cures like that? Like the ones on the other side of the lake that they perhaps heard of? How much would Jesus have been able to do for them if they'd not ejected him from their shores? But no, they chose rather to think about any further damage that might occur to their livelihoods, it seems. And well, the thought occurred that this really was putting swine before pearls, but I don't know whether that's the right way to put it. Jesus never forced his presence upon anyone, did he? Neither did he encourage his followers to do that either. But let us remind ourselves of what happened to Legion. Did he change his name or go back to his old name, I wonder? It's worth noting that Jesus never called him Legion. He only asked his name. He didn't call him that. Mark 5 and verse 18. "And when he was come into the ship, he that had been possessed with the devil," still that word demon there, "prayed him that he might be with him." So this man wanted to be with Jesus in the boat. "Howbeit, Jesus suffered him not, but saith unto him, Go home to thy friends and tell them how great things the Lord hath done for thee and hath had compassion on thee." And we notice Jesus emphasized the compassion in his act here. This was the motive that drove the Lord, or one of the motives at least, that drove the Lord to take an interest in and to cure this man. Legion was an outcast from the world he'd grown up in. He was living among the tombs, waiting for the day of his own death, living amongst the dead and waiting for his own death. And with his tendency for self-harm and the presence of wild animals and the dangers in that area, that might have come quite quickly, mightn't it? But he now had an opportunity to turn his wonderful knowledge of who Jesus was into good news for others. Did Legion do it? Well, he did, didn't he? Jesus said, "Return to your own house, show how great things God has done unto thee." And he went his way and published throughout the whole city, how great things Jesus had done unto him. Mark uses similar wording, adding, "and all men did marvel." Legion was very successful in spreading this good news. Now, if an apostle is one sent, and Legion was sent by the Lord, and he did the job, then was this the first apostle to the Gentiles? There's a little thought. So now we come to that question which we always seem to ask. Why did Jesus do it? What's it teaching us? What links are there with the Old Testament? And of course we can't cover much of this now, time's going. So attempts have been made to apply to Legion's thinking an awareness of Israel's deliverance from Egypt, which he, it is said, did not feel worthy of. And it's pointed out, as people try to make a connection here, people make a connection between the tombs and Egypt being the land of tombs, and therefore there's a parallel between this man's situation in Egypt. To me, it doesn't seem a very strong or compelling link, but I'll put it there for you to consider. There's one verse right at the end of Micah's prophecy, which, if it was known by Legion, may have had special significance. I'll just read to you Micah 7 and verse 19. He, that's God, God will turn again. He will have compassion on us. He will subdue our iniquities, and thou wilt cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Because of the link with the animals and them drowning in the sea. Possibly. Maybe it's good to look at the immediate picture. Who was with Jesus to learn from this miracle? Who would be talking to Jesus as they crossed back to the other side in the boat? Who would be talking about it amongst themselves? Well, the disciples, surely. And what had they learned? Well, they had learned that they'd been to a Gentile shore in Roman territory. They'd seen Jesus heal a physically unclean man, ceremonially unclean and mentally unstable. And this man would be less appealing, I think, to a Jew than a Samaritan. You know, he was the lowest of the low in many ways, wasn't he? And yet he was healed by Jesus, who'd had compassion on him, and had then commissioned him to go and spread the good news about how he'd been healed. That would give the disciples something to think about. How would they ever be able even to think about refusing to take the gospel to anyone in future? Same applies to us today. I'd like to end by referring again to the commission that Jesus gave Legion. Mark 5, verse 19. Go home to thy friends, tell them how great things the Lord has done for thee, and hath had compassion on thee. We can apply that to ourselves. The wording Jesus used is identical to that which we find in Psalm 126. Then was our mouth filled with laughter, and our tongue with singing. Then said they among the heathen, the Lord hath done great things for them. Very similar words. Did the disciples reflect on those words of that psalm as they travelled back? And now, words which we can wholeheartedly join in with from Psalm 126 against the background of what we've looked at tonight. The Lord hath done great things for us, whereof we are glad.